Hey, this is Pat Hentgen with the Toronto Blue Jays. You're listening to The Walk-Off with Scott and Adam.
Baseball, Blue Jays, and more baseball. It's The Walk-Off with Scott Belford and Adam Mack.
This ball is crushed.
The Die Hard podcast for the casual fan.
And another one.
So thrilled to be joined by today's guest, former pitcher for the Toronto Blue Jays, big-time contributing member to that 1993 World Series winning Jays team and the 1996 American League Cy Young Award winner, Pat Hentgen. Welcome to The Walk-Off, my man. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, my pleasure. My pleasure. I know we've been hitting each other up on Twitter, so finally got it.
Yeah, we finally connected. Absolutely. We're so excited to talk baseball with you. I know before this pandemic hit, you were still a special assistant with the Blue Jays. I also know that a bunch of those special assistants right across baseball, all organizations included, kind of went to the wayside with COVID. Are you still a consultant on some level with this Jays team?
No, they just basically told us all that we were going to transition to a part-time role. My role prior to that was already very small. Right. I was in player development. I did some scouting. I did a little bit of consulting in the front office, but that was like two regimes ago. This past regime, I was really basically in player development. And, you know, I think there was a lot of people that lost their jobs, not just special assistants. There were so many good minor league player development people across the board with every organization. So I think every team averaged like 30 to 40 people that were let go.
Yeah, it's wild what happened. Is this the longest you've gone without being big time in baseball? Like, how did you spend your 2021?
Yeah, that's a great question. It was hard. I mean, I didn't follow baseball as much as I have in the past, that's for sure. I just kind of recently kind of piqued my interest because the Jays been playing so darn great.
Yeah,
it's just incredible. But yeah, you know, I just stay busy by, you know, visiting my kids. I have a daughter who lives in Chicago. I have another daughter in East Lansing. My other daughter's in Canton, Michigan. So did a little traveling, stayed within the state of Michigan, of course, because of the restrictions, but went to the Upper Peninsula, spent some time up there. So I've been staying busy.
Right on. I know, so most of our guests on the show here, Pat, are minor league prospects in the Jays system, and I did want to talk to you about your minor league grind, because you started pro ball in 1986 when you were drafted by the Jays, and then you didn't get your first call up until 91, and then even then, you were kind of up and down from Syracuse and stuff until that 93 All-Star season when you won the World Series. How difficult is the yo-yo of going up and down between the bigs and AAA? Because I know we just saw Trent Thornton with this current Jays team option back to Buffalo, and it's probably the third or fourth time that he's been down and then called back up. What was your experience with this, and how difficult is it to be sent down and then have, you know, have the high of being brought up and then being sent down and still trying to stay focused and
Yeah. Well, first I'll address it. I'll address this with when I played and how it felt when I got called up. So when I played, Gillick was our general manager, and we didn't really see a lot of movement within the season. You know, you started your year in Dunedin, Florida for an A-ball. You pretty much finished the year there, unless there was a need and you were really, really dominating and you may have been old for that league. So when I look back on my minor league career, yes, it was a grind. It was 5 years plus a half season. My first year in AAA, 1991, Guzman and I actually were leading the rotation. And Dave Steeb got hurt, and Juan Guzman got called up. And at the time, he deserved it. He was pitching much better than me, and people forget how great he was during the World Series years. He's one of my favorite teammates, and he was one of the greatest pitchers that just doesn't get the love, I think. He started game one in both World Series.
Yeah.
So anyway, and then, you know, and nowadays with the minor leagues, how they're doing it, what they're doing is instead of using 15 pitchers to get through a big league season and maybe three or four guys from AAA that get a chance back when I played, now you're looking at teams that use 30 pitchers, sometimes 40 pitchers to get through 50 pitchers to get through a big league season. It's funny, when I was the bullpen coach in 11 and 13, I remember thinking to myself, I have guys behind me that are in the big leagues that don't want to pitch in a game right now because they know no matter how well they do, they could punch out the side, they're getting sent down because we're going to need a fresh arm for tomorrow because our starter only went two innings tonight. So the players are smart like that. It's very hard and very difficult to stay confident when you keep getting optioned down. And I think that's one of the things that impacts the players that you can't really measure.
Yeah, that is a little bit of an intangible there. When you were coaching, what would you tell these guys? Like, is there a way to mentally prepare them for this yo-yo of if they have options, they're going to be sent up and down?
Yeah. you know, as a front office personnel, you're one of the big focuses, how many optional relievers do you have? How many guys in our bullpen? Yeah. When we leave spring training, how many optional relievers are we going to have? Because we know that a starter's going to get hit in the shin with a line drive in the first inning, and it's going to bury our bullpen on Tuesday night, and Wednesday we're going to be. So you need to have optional relievers. I understand that. The difference was, in my era, the starting pitchers took on a lot of responsibility to eat innings. And I was raised that way. When I brought up through the minor leagues, I was that way. And now the front offices are asking the starting pitchers to just get through the lineup two times. We're not really asking you to get to that seventh or eighth inning anymore. And you're just seeing a lot of pitching staffs that are going to be 35, 45-man pitching staffs.
Do you think there's any rolling this back, or do you think this is just baseball now?
Well, I think the true starting pitchers, and I don't mean to say that some of them aren't true starting pitchers, but a lot of these good starting pitchers that are out there right now, they're still doing their six or seven innings every time, and no one's even, you know, no one talks about it. Yeah. Everybody talks about the guy that goes three innings and can't get through the lineup, and he's winning 5-0 in the fifth with 60 pitches, and he's got, you know, two hits. Maybe I've even seen a guy had a no-hitter one time, I think, through five, and they took him out. So yeah. It's going to happen. I mean, guys are just managing the games based on the statistics and not so much on their feel.
Yeah, I mean, Corbin Burnes just finished pitching an 8-inning no-hitter, and then they still brought in for Milwaukee there. They still went to the bullpen. Like,
I couldn't imagine being out on the mound in the 8th inning with a no-hitter, your heart's racing through your jersey, and the manager's telling you, no, you're done. I'm like, I'm done. I'm 3 outs away. I got 24 outs. Come on now. You know, that would be my mindset, but
108 you know, pitches he was at, Pat. So, like, how many? It wasn't even 108. It wasn't crazy. Like, it wasn't even a wild.
That's fantastic to get through 8 innings with 108 pitches. I mean, he deserves it. And it's a no-hitter. If I just had a shutout, I'd want to finish the game.
Well, that's a great question because yesterday we just saw Alek Manoah pitch against the Rays through 8 innings, 1 hit. We had an 8-0 lead going into the 9th, and they wouldn't let him finish the game.
Yeah, those are – what was his pitch count at, just out of curiosity?
97 pitches.
Yeah, see, I think that's a no-brainer. I finished the game. I let my pen rest. I mean, you know, at that point, you know, even if you don't even have to get anybody up maybe, or maybe you get somebody up when he goes out in the 9th, and if he gets the first guy on, you got a guy ready.
Sure.
But maybe he has a 6-pitch 9th, a 7-pitch 9th, and he finishes the first complete game of his career, something that you'll remember the rest of your life.
Exactly.
I only had like 20 or so in my career, and I remember them, man. They were cool. There is not a better feeling for a pitcher to shake hands on that mound when you're winning, when you won the game. Pretty cool feeling.
So I know that you spent a stint with the team in 1992, even though you did spend time with Syracuse. Do you have a World Series ring for 92 as well?
Yeah. So what happened was I made the team out of spring training because I was out of options.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, you know, if you were out of options and you got sent down, well, it's still the same way. Any team could pick you up. So they were pretty much forced to carry me. And I stayed in the team. I stayed up on the team. And then I think Stottlemyre got hurt or something. I can't remember. I got sent down. I got back. Then Stottlemyre got hurt and I got called back up. That's what it was.
Right.
Yeah. You know, when you're that 10th or 11th guy on the staff and you're in the bullpen, you know, I was a long reliever at the time and our starters were so good. I would go 10, 12 days without pitching sometimes, I remember. And
how hard is that to go that long without pitching?
It is tough because, you know, I was groomed. I pitched every fifth day for 5.5 straight years in the minor leagues. And I got to the big leagues and I was put in the bullpen. I'd never warmed up that fast. I'd never had to pitch back-to-back days. Cito Gaston actually was fantastic. He used to call my first game. He called down in the seventh inning and said, or he called down in the fifth inning and said, Henkin, you got the 8th and 9th. I'll never forget that. Yeah. And that was one of my first games in the big leagues in the bullpen in 91 in September. Yeah. He had really good feel like that for his pitchers. And, I think Galen Sisco did too back then.
Yeah, that's really cool. I mean, it must have been kind of surreal to go from, and I'm not downplaying it, but from a minor contributor on a stacked juggernaut team that was the 1992 World Series Toronto Blue Jays to literally a major contributor in 93's World Series victory where you were an all-star, you won 19 games, you won a game in the World Series. Like at 24 years old, did you truly comprehend what you were accomplishing?
No, heck no. No, as a matter of fact, in 92, I was so nervous pitching. It was ridiculous. I couldn't get comfortable coming out of that pen. So when I went into spring training in 93, another shot at being in the rotation, we had signed Dave Stewart that offseason. And I'm like, man, oh, man, you know, now that bumps me back to six. So me and Light are going to spring training, and we're battling it out. And Al had a better spring than me. And off to the pen I went in April, and Dave Stewart got hurt, I think, one of his first or second starts in Seattle. And I filled in for him, and I won like six or seven games in a row. And then when Stu came back, Leiter went to the pen. And that's how that hole went down. I mean, you got to grab the opportunity. You know, Cito gave me the opportunity in a championship-type caliber team and gave me the ball every fifth day. You know, you just did your best to try to take advantage of that. And then, you know, I think in baseball, it's one of those sports where if you don't continually try to get better, people are going to come and catch you.
You kind of brought up wins for a second there. Just – because in the 90s, wins was such a big stat. Like, pitching stat in baseball just seems to not put the same sort of emphasis and stock on wins that it used to. And that said, don't get me wrong, 20 wins is still a lead in today's game. But in the 90s, wins reigned supreme. Like, the pitcher stock piling up wins were the most sought-after pitchers. How big was it for you in that 1996 Cy Young winning year that you hit that 20 mark? Because you were at 19 and 93. You were very close. Like, was 20 significant to you?
Yeah, I mean, in order to win 20, you need a lot of things to happen. First, you need offensive support. Second, you need a good bullpen behind you that don't blow games. I know the 1 year I think I left was with the lead seven times and got no decisions. So you can't have that type of season. You can't have that. And I wasn't going five and fly. I mean, I was going like six, seven innings every time.
Yeah.
So those things happen, and unfortunately, you always say to yourself when you're in the locker room watching, man, I should have just finished the game. You know, if I had enough pitches, you know, that was the only thing I could really fall back on was get all 27 outs instead of complaining that your bullpen couldn't get you six outs or they couldn't get you five outs. But, yeah, it's funny how they don't really focus on the wins. I think at the time in 96, I came down to the stretch about – I remember there was a month to go in the season, and we were playing the Orioles, and Messina, who I really looked up to, he was really set the bar in my era. I said, Moose came out and pitched a great game in Toronto. And then he came out and said, oh man, Hentgen's stats are better than Pettit's and that he's a front runner. That really made me feel an extra boost of confidence when I needed it.
Yeah.
And it came from an opposing player who was playing the same position as me that everybody in the American League looked up to because he was one of the most elite, consistent pitchers in the era. And for him to come out and say that was pretty darn cool. And then the last month went and Mel Queen was a pitching coach and he said, you know, we can massage this rotation maybe and get you an extra start the last day of the year, but you got to pitch on 3 days rest on your next start. So that was an easy decision for me. I said, okay, so boom, we did that. Well, lo and behold, I got my 20th on the last day of the year.
Wow.
Yeah, Brady Anderson led the game off with a solo homer. And then I ended up going, I think, seven innings. I think we won the game 3-1. And Spoljarek and Timlin came in and cleaned up my mess late in the game, and I got the win. Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Like, man, what's funny is about that year you won the Cy Young that I remember is how strong you came on after the All-Star break. Like, I think you won Player of the Month in July and August. And like you just said, like, last game of the year is when you got that 20th win. Do you remember that post-All-Star game stretch? Like, looking back on your career, those 2 months, did you feel like it was the best you'd ever been or just the best you'd ever executed, or did it even stand out to you as anything more than just part of the season?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, 96 is a year I didn't make the All-Star team, but I won the Cy Young that year. Yeah. It's kind of strange. And, you know, the second half, you're right. I think I went like a bunch of starts in a row where I was going six or seven innings and I had a bunch of CGs in a row 1 month. You know what? You just get into that confidence where your physical attributes and your mental all kind of come together at the same time. And that's kind of what happened at that range of 94, 5, 6, 7. There was a nice 5-year stretch I had in Toronto where it was like physically I felt really good and strong. And mentally every day I just got better at becoming a better pitcher, learning how to self-coach. And I think that coming down that stretch on the road, I pitched a lot better on the road as a Blue Jay. You know, I don't know if anyone knows that, but my splits were better on the road.
Toronto's, what do you think that was?
Oh, Toronto's not a pitcher-friendly park.
Well, I mean, yeah.
That was. I mean, you know, the ball flies. Guys love hitting there. The hitting eye is fantastic. All the hitters love hitting there. The ball carries. There's no wind. When I played, it was a hard turf. This newer turf slowed the ball down a lot for the pitchers. So I think
not
it was
as many
just
kind of those bouncing doubles into the corner, right? Yeah.
Right. I give up a ball between the shortstop and second baseman, and it went all the way to the wall. Now go figure that one. That's how fast that surface was. Now, don't get me wrong. The guy crushed the ball. I mean, the ball was probably 110 miles an hour. But, I mean, it was just hard to fathom that it could get between the two middle infielders and still sneak to the wall. It was fast back then.
Are you, out of curiosity, are you still in touch? Like, are you still pals with a bunch of those guys you won that World Series with? Like, I know that was a long time ago, but are you still in touch with some of those guys?
So I stay in touch with about a handful of guys that I played with in the 90s. You know, right off the top of my head, Sprague, Green, Williams, Sprague. I talk to Dwayne Ward once in a while. I've seen Stottlemyre and Hanke at some of the reunions. You know, we all kind of spread apart, right, and go back to where they're from. But we've been together and fished together at times and hunted together with some of my ex-teammates. And, yeah, still I stay in touch with some of the guys.
Yeah, that's cool. I know we had Sean Green on the show a few months back, and it was interesting to me when he brought up, and you kind of touched on it in 92 there, how you felt about it. But in 93, like, he was a rookie. He didn't play very much. He got a World Series ring. And he told us that when he got that ring, in his head, he was like, well, I didn't really contribute much. This isn't that big of a deal. I'll get my ring when it's a big deal, you know? And now he's like, he brought up, he's like, boy, I wish I had savored that a little bit more in 1993. How big is knowing how to win? Like, you see teams that get close and it's almost like they need that extra experience, or they bring in one vet or whatever it is. How big, I know it's an intangible I'm asking you about here, but how big is knowing how to win?
No, that's a good question. I think that it really falls on the veterans. I mean, it really does. I mean, we had really good veterans. And I think when you become a veteran, it's kind of hard because you're like at that year four or five, and then you start to transition. You start looking around the clubhouse, you go, man, oh man, like I've been here as long as anybody. Wow. You know, now I've been here long, you know, and then pretty soon you're like, wow, there's young pitchers like Chris Carpenter, Roy Halladay staring at me, watching me do my tubing and stuff in my chair, you know, in my locker. But I think veterans definitely set the culture. And I think that the coaching staff can set a really good culture too. I mean, it all starts obviously with the manager in the dugout, because there's such a dynamic in that dugout to have energy and intensity and optimism and, you know, fun. You got to have all those things in the dugout. And if you have a staff that's kind of a downer and negative, it's just brutal, man. Baseball's played every day. And I remember Jeter saying this when he played, you got to have fun. And I think that that's the key thing with veterans. They're looser. They bring a fun to the clubhouse. The young guys are all walking around like eggshells. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
At least when I played, that's how it was. When I coached, they might not walk around in eggshells as much, but they still do. I think they still do.
So they're almost following the lead. If veterans are laid back and cool and calm, everyone just kind of follows that lead, eh?
I think so. I mean, you know, a veteran guy in the bullpen is always key. A veteran guy on the bench is always a nice thing. A veteran catcher is big too, because he handles half your pitching, or he handles the entire pitch staff, but he also handles half your roster. So I always felt like the catcher was a good indicator on a team's culture and a team's intensity, because he's got to do it every day and be back there nursing the pitcher.
How important is the catcher? Like, how much time did you spend back in your career going over the game plans with your catcher and your pitching coaches? Like, how they always talk about the relationship between a pitcher and a catcher mattering. Is it as big a deal as some baseball analysts figure it is, or is it overblown, or does it depend on the pitcher and catcher themselves?
Well, I can tell you this, that as a pitcher, you can't rely on your catcher and be married to him, because they get traded, they get released, they start batting 200, and next thing you know, you got the backup guy in there catching you. So you can't really get too addicted to one of your catchers. But I will say this, it makes a huge impact. Absolutely makes a big impact. Especially if you have a guy that you feel confident with his pitch selection. A lot of pitchers like Mark Burley, for instance, when I coach there, and even myself, we like to be like working bees. So I really liked a catcher that just pumped the signs, kept me going, kept the rhythm going. The infielders love it. Everybody loves it. So having a good catcher and having that relationship is important. I shagged all the time with my catchers. I always constantly tried to talk about the hitters I was going to face. Basically how it went when I played is we had a meeting the first day of the series. We went over all their position players. We went over all their bench players. All the pitchers were in the same room together. Then you go to a Q&A. Then you go to like some veteran guys. Like we had Darren Oliver. It'd be like, hey, Oliver, how do you pitch to Miguel Cabrera? You know, and then Oliver would take the room and he'd help out some of the pitchers in the room. Some guys weren't verbal. Some guys didn't want to be asked questions. Some guys like Burley didn't even want to go to the meetings. Burley wanted to just be a working bee. He said, you know what? I don't want to get over caught up in who, how I pitch guys. He said, just give me the pitch and I'm going to hit the glove. You know, so he kept it simple.
Yeah. And you said you kind of were a guy, too, that didn't really shake off signs very often. You just kind of trusted the catcher.
Yeah, I mean, I looked at, obviously, when you play in the big leagues, you're the greatest scout. All I did was watch games when I played.
Yeah.
And starting pitcher, you have the luxury of watching 4 to 5 games. I'm constantly watching their hitters. I'm constantly watching what our pitchers are trying to do to them. Is he late on the heater? Is he pulling the off-speed pitch? You know, is he hitting balls up the middle? All those things, as you're watching in the game, you're watching all these things take place. And then you correlate that with your meeting with the pitching coach, and you correlate that with your catcher. And all of a sudden, the next thing you know, you got a good game plan. Now, whether you can execute that, that's a whole other animal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How much of an anomaly is a Mark Burley? A guy who's just like, I don't even want to turn my brain on. I'm just going to execute. Tell me where you want it. Tell me what you want.
Yeah, he actually asked Pete and I if he could just not go to the meetings. And I was like, I mean, I didn't care. I mean, it's better than you being in there and just being sleeping the whole time. You know what I mean? So
he looks like a snorer.
Yeah. No, Burley was great, man. That guy was so underrated. He was great. Yeah, I lost my train of thought. I lost your question. What was it again?
Just what an anomaly he was, that he would just turn his brain off and just do whatever you said, pretty much. Like,
right. Well, it's funny. I mean, when I played with Clemens, I remember him asking me how to face how we pitch this guy. And I remember sitting in my mind, I'm going, you're the Rocket, man. Like, why are you asking me this? Like, you're asking me. And you know what he told me? You're going to freak. He said, I don't keep track of the hitters. He said, I've been in the league so long. He said, I keep track of the umps. And I was like, really? He goes, yeah, I got a book on the umps. Well, some umps give you a little on the corner, some give you the high one. He's like, some give you the hang and breaking ball, some don't. He's like, I've been in the league so long. He goes, the hitters are just a revolving door. So that goes to show you how a guy like Clemens and a guy like Burley kept it simple, man, the KISS method.
I know you were mentioning Pete Walker very quickly there. And I mean, the fact you brought him up, he gets all sorts of credit for his pitching acumen. How important is a pitching coach? As a former pitcher yourself, like, what were you after in your pitching coaches, and what makes a really good pitching coach?
I think the best pitching coach I ever had was a guy named Mel Queen. Well, I know for sure he was, but the reasons I think were, and I'm going to try to say this, you have to care about players before they care what you know. Wait, you have to show the player that you care before they care what you know. And Mel was the best at that, man. He was like a friend, a/brother, a/dad. And when you're a young kid in the minor leagues and you're traveling and you're away from home at 18, you need somebody like that. And Mel provided that for us when I was in the minor leagues. Then he gets called up to the big leagues when I'm in right before the 96 season. And I won the Cy Young the first year as a pitch coacher. So I think the best thing he did was he instilled confidence. He kept things simple. I remember I'd hang my breaking ball when I first was in the minor leagues with him. And he looked at me and he said, what do you think you did wrong there? And I said, and I'm sitting there trying to make something up. I'm like, And he goes, you didn't do anything wrong. You just let go of the ball too soon. And I'll never forget that, because I was sitting there thinking, as an 18-year-old kid, I got to overanalyze this. I got to figure out, you know, all this crap. Where's my wrist and my hand and my release point? He's like, no, they're everything the same. Just hang on to it a little bit longer. And boom, next thing you know, it's at the knees. You know, so it was just simple little tweaks like that, and building the confidence. Queen was good at that.
That's, yeah, just making you believe in yourself, I guess, eh? That
it's so hard to confident, you guys. It's so hard to stay confident in MLB, man. You fail so much, and the guys are so good and so fast. And especially if you're a hitter and you're 0-4 on Tuesday, and now the next day you got Scherzer. Now you're 0-4. Then the next day you got Kershaw. Now, and then the next day you got, you know what I mean? Like, it just never ends in the big leagues.
And you're like, can I even hit anymore? Like,
yeah. And same with pitching. You're laying in bed at night and you're thinking about the lineup. You're on the road. You're in Baltimore and you're going, okay, Brady Anderson, Cal Ripken, BJ Surhoff, you know, and you're just going down the lineup, and you know, Albert Bell, and you're just looking at yourself and you're going, whoa, man, when you're not doing well, you're laying in bed going, those guys rake. And then, but when you're in your sweet spot and you're doing well, you're laying in bed going, I got it. Brady Anderson down and away. Cal, I'm going to pound up and in. Albert, I'm going to throw myself. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it was amazing how the mindset and the confidence keeps you playing better.
You're a Detroit boy, right?
Yeah. 45 minutes from Detroit and Windsor.
Were you well-versed in Canadiana before you were drafted in 86?
No, not really. I mean, you know, No, not really. I mean, I spent my 19th birthday in Canada when I was in the minor leagues because of drinking.
You could drink.
Yeah. But other than that, yeah, no, not really. I mean, my parents had a lot of relatives still do in Canada. My mom and dad did. And, you know, other than that, not really.
Well, I mean, you're pretty much an honorary Canadian at this point. I mean, you were inducted into the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame back in 2016. Canadians have just kind of always adopted you as one of our own. How cool was it for you to be inducted into the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame? And how cool has it been to kind of have this connection with a country that you aren't from?
Yeah, no, it's been great, man. As a matter of fact, I've had a cabin in the Bancroft area for 20 plus years and been going to Canada for all these years, even after my playing career. It's one of those things where, you know, I got drafted by a team 4 hours from my hometown. And at year two in my big league career, Gillick and Gordash came and gave me an extension. 2 years into that extension, they gave me another 2 years. So it was just like, man, I couldn't turn it down. I just loved Toronto too much. I mean, it was close to home and my parents could come see the games at the time. My wife could drive home. We went on the road. Really cool place.
Yeah. And I'm curious here because this is something that not like new Canadian baseball fans never got to experience this. But as a kid, like, Pat, my fave is when they finally let American League teams play National League teams, and then all of a sudden the Montreal Expos and the Toronto Blue Jays started to have series, and even more exciting is when they line that series up on Canada Day. That must have been a cool experience for you. Like, what was that like?
It was. I faced Pedro, and he beat me 1-0. And it was a really cool game. I'll never forget it. I remember calling my dad that night. And saying, my dad said, man, oh, man, you matched Pedro. And I said, Dad, if you saw the game, it was men among boys. I said, we didn't hit a ball hard. We never got a ball out of the infield. I said, I had guys on base all game, double plays, line drives at people. I said, balls to the warning track. I mean, it was a big difference. He punched out a lot of guys. But that was a great experience to pitch there for a whole country. Going on the road on the West Coast to Seattle, you got 25,000 Canadians there. Yeah. You go to Detroit back in the day when I was playing, Detroit was a huge rivalry. We'd have 30,000 Canadians across the border jamming that Tiger Stadium. I mean, it was literally like home games back then.
Yeah, the Canadians travel pretty well.
Yeah, they do. And you asked me earlier about the Canadian Hall of Fame. I wanted to mention, I got sidetracked a little bit, but the Canadian Hall of Fame was a great experience. My family loved it. My kids loved it. They were like, God, I can't believe all these people want Dad's autograph. I remember my daughter's. And then, you know, the only thing I remember was I was nervous about the speech. I went last. Dennis Martinez went right before me. And I was a little bit nervous. I had some bullet points, but I remember I kind of got off track a little bit when I was doing my speech. But in the end, I think it went okay. And it was a great experience.
Yeah, that's very cool. I know, we were talking about the Expos and the Blue Jays. I know Anthony Telford has been on the show a couple times, and he reached out and was like, oh, you got Pat on the show. Tell him I say hello. So
yeah, Telly's great. Yeah, I know Telly.
Isn't he? He's a fun dude. Boy, does that man know pitching. So number one, I do want to say thank you very, very much. I know that you're on a time crunch here, so we're going to get crap from our listeners if we don't flip to listener questions right away here. So
Let's do it.
I'll throw to Adam here, and we'll take it away. Go ahead, Adam.
Okay, awesome. So our first one here is from Derek in Panama, who says, I was disappointed to hear that Pat was no longer coaching with the Blue Jays. Does he have any plans to coach again one day?
Oh, good question. So I've been approached to do some amateur coaching here in my hometown. We have an independent baseball team I've been approached to meet with. I'm not sure exactly what role they're thinking. There's some high schools that are around in the area that have contacted me as well. But for the most part, I haven't got back into pro ball. I haven't really sent out a resume or anything like that. I kind of got my fingers crossed that maybe someday we'll get back to normal and I'll be back at J.
Yeah.
Love to hear that. Awesome. Okay. Amanda asks, how would you pitch to Vlad Jr. today?
Just like his dad, right at his neck. And he could still put a barrel on it. That guy, his dad was incredible, and his son's just as good. He might be better. I mean, he has been spectacular this year, and it's been so much fun to watch. And I remember when we went to the Dominican, I went with the old regime with Alex and a couple of his assistant GMs. We went down to the Dominican to see him at 16. And lo and behold, we get him signed and we get the instructional ball, and I'm standing in the outfield with or next to the dugout with Devon White. And he says, who's that guy with that bat speed? He didn't know. I said, that's Vladdy. He goes, you're kidding me. I said, no. And it was like, that's how much he stuck out.
Yeah. Well, Scott was mentioning your induction into the Canadian Hall of Fame. Congrats, by the way. And
yeah, thank you.
I remember Roy Halladay's Hall of Fame speech for the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame, because he got inducted the same year as Vlad Sr. So he had a story about Vlad Sr. and the strategy for getting him out was to walk him and try and pick him off at first.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
The hard part was just throwing four balls that he wouldn't swing at. So
we used to say, if you could throw it between the dugouts, he'll put wood on it.
Yeah, what an amazing hitting family that is, for sure.
No doubt.
Okay, so Steve Bradley says, would you ever get back into baseball full time? I guess we kind of covered this question, but he says, specifically, perhaps maybe future manager of the Blue Jays?
Oh, I'd love to manage.
Yeah.
I would love to manage. I mean, who wouldn't? I think it's a great job, and you get to create culture, you get to create mood, you get to create intensity. That's a great job.
All right. So Alex Jessup says, what was it like playing with Roger Clemens and Roy Halladay?
Very similar approach. Very businesslike, a great ability to put the horse blinders on and concentrate. Excellent inner confidence. Both of them had a lot of inner confidence. It may not have shown as much when they walked around the locker room, but Clemens was a phenomenal mechanical guy, a great delivery, great mechanics, great control, and an excellent competitor. Halladay, pretty much the same thing. The thing with Halladay was that he used to throw traditionally, as you guys know, and then Mel and Bobby took him down to the minor leagues back then and revamped his sidearm delivery. It's a real amazing what he did, Roy Halladay, to throw your whole life from 8 years old all the way to the big leagues, and then go back to A-ball, and then come back and have a Hall of Fame career. I always tell people, Doc would have probably been a Hall of Famer over the top. He was that good. He was that good. And just everybody has trouble getting established in the big leagues, no matter who you are. I mean, some guys don't, like Griffey and Vladdy, guys like right. that. But I'm talking about most of the guys do. But Roy and Clemens were I threw with both. They were my throwing partners, actually, both times. I threw with Doc for the years I played with him, and I threw with Clemens for the years I played with him. Both of them had very similar throwing routines daily. And they were hard workers. They had that in common.
Out of curiosity, before I let you take back over here, Adam, you mentioned how Halladay and Clemens were very businesslike. Did you have pitchers in the rotation that you were on the team at times where one was like just very not businesslike and very goofy and like maybe not quite as focused? Like were there guys like that on the team?
I don't stick around too long.
No, they don't.
They usually don't do well enough to stick around long enough. Yeah, you got to be a grinder. You got to be a competitor. You got to persevere. You got to be able to get over failure, soreness, stiffness, bad calls. I mean, you're out there a long time. You're out there for six innings. I mean, you get exposed if you're not good. And so those starting pitchers typically don't stick around. I do have a couple that come to mind, though. Sean Markham, when he played with Halladay.
Right.
Sean Markham, great pitcher, man. What a pitcher. What an athlete. He was not a great worker. And Halladay asked me to come to Toronto when I was doing my special assistant stuff and talk to him. And I remember sitting in the office with him and Doc and saying, you know, you got to get going, buddy. You know, like, I know you're having success right now, but you want to stay 10 years, you know, and it's going to get harder and harder and harder. And he made it to the big league throwing 89, 88.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, you log 200 innings for 2-3 years in a row, you might be throwing 84 if you don't work hard. Yeah. And, So I think that then I remember thinking, Doc, you're Roy Halladay. Like, what am I going to tell Sean Markham? You know what I mean? Like, Doc had already had a Cy Young. He was already the man. So we had talked to him and you know, we had a little brief discussion, and I don't think it ever really worked out. I don't think Doc could ever get to that kid. You know, I think he tried. And the other guy was Wells. I mean, Wells is a great pitcher. He arguably Hall of Fame stats. I mean, the guy was phenomenal. And I'll tell you what, he spent 6 years in the pen before he even became a starting pitcher. Yeah. The guy could have been sniffing 300 wins, man.
Yeah.
I mean, he was good. And, you know, but he was a guy that he didn't have to work as hard as the rest of us. And again, very great, a great athlete. People don't realize that about Wells. In 92, we ran, they timed us, fastest pitcher in camp.
What?
David Wells.
Wow. Would have never guessed, man.
Get this, man. Throws a football like an NFL quarterback left-handed. Hits a golf ball. When I played with him when we were younger, he hit a golf ball 300 yards, man. Dunk a basketball. Like, people didn't realize, like, Boomer was a good athlete, man. Wow. He still is a good athlete. You should see him play golf right now. He's like 56. Yeah.
All right. Well, here's one of my favorite questions to ask. And when we spoke to Sean Green, he loved the idea. So the PGA, you just mentioned golfing. So the PGA has the Champions Tour, right? Like a senior league, essentially. If the MLB had a Legends League of sorts with like eight teams and like a 40 to 50 game schedule, what would your interest be in playing in a league like that?
What's the age limit?
Well, it would be like 45 plus.
Oh, I'm in 45 plus. Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. I'd play. I actually pitched in a men's league here in Detroit. It's like a Detroit men's senior baseball league. And I was 45 and older. It was kind of fun. I mean, we had a lot of fun. A lot of baseball junkies like us, you know, just sit around the parking lot and tailgate. Yeah. After the games, I'd do it.
That's awesome.
At what age would you say no to that? 35? You're like, no, 35 is too young.
Yeah, it's a good question. I guess the question is wood bat versus aluminum. I wouldn't do aluminum. And I wouldn't. Yeah, 35 and under is pretty young, man. That's I would have. Yeah, you gotta get up there.
Yeah. All right, I love it. Okay, so Michelle from Edmonton asks, 31 complete games with your time in Toronto. How do you feel about the way pitching is used nowadays? And I know you kind of touched on this earlier, but.
Yeah. I understand it's all done with analytics and how they measure. And they look at a guy like Henkin, he's tired in the seventh inning and, you know, batters are batting 320 off him in the third time through, but only 220 the first time through. I get that. But I also feel like when you have a starting pitcher that's on a roll and he's doing well, man, it's hard to get five guys out of your pen to go four scoreless. All five guys got to have good games. You know, if one guy comes in and has a dud, the next thing you know, you're down by three and it's the eighth inning and you only got, you know, an inning left to try to score back. So I like to see managers stretch their starter a little bit more because I think it also instills confidence in your starting pitchers because they're getting out of their own jams. But, I guess it's using your feel versus analytics all the time. Most of the managers manage with the analytics that don't want to be second-guessed. Like, why did you leave him in there? You know he gets hammered the third time through. Yeah, but he was dealing. Yeah, it doesn't matter. You should have hooked them. You know what I mean? Like, So it's a tough call.
All right, last one here from the listeners. Jonathan says, and this is a fun one, how do you think this team today stacks up against your 92-93 team?
So the 92 team had, I thought, better pitching. The 93 team had better offense. We had a great bullpen both years. Wardle was our anchor, man. He was phenomenal. Dwayne Ward was incredible in the night. From the time he became a Jay till the time he left, he was great. He was such a horse. He got the biggest outs in our pen. But other than that, I think this team today, you know, you go around the horn, man, Ole or Vladdy. You got to go Vladdy. You know, Alomar, you got to go Alomar.
Yeah.
You know, Bo, you probably got to go Bo. You know, third, we had Gruber. Man, you're not beating Gruber. He was great. And then the next year we had Sprague at 25 bombs, hit eighth.
That's right. He did hit 25 bombs in that eight hole. Wow. Yeah.
I forgot. And then you got Devon White. Nobody's out running the ball there. Joe Carter was great. I don't know. Those are good teams, man. That's not an easy comp. That's a tough team. This team's got to keep going. I'll tell you what, they're getting hot at the right time. Their starting pitching has been phenomenal. We got that bullpen hang in there, man. And they got a chance to go all the way, I think.
I know before we let you go here, I know you touched on Wardo really quick. What does it take to be that back end of the bullpen horse that just ends games?
Wardo was a starting pitcher. You know, they had asked Wardo to be a starter, and I think he told him no, he'd rather be in the pen. And he was just so durable and wanted the ball all the time. He was like Quantrill. Quantrill is the same way in my era. Quantrill wanted the ball, pitched in 80 games. I mean, it was the same as Ward. The only difference was Ward usually would get five or six outs. And he struck out a lot of guys, so he threw a lot of pitches to get through his outs, where Quantrill was more of a sinker guy. He got a lot of ground balls. But it takes a horse. It takes a tough mental kid. And you have to be able to, you know, blow the game on Monday and get up on Tuesday. Sun comes up, you got to go back Tuesday and have confidence. That's not easy.
The brain, yeah.
It's not easy, yep.
All right, Pat, honestly, thank you so very much for taking the time to talk to us. Honestly, like 11-year-old me is losing his mind right now. So
awesome, brother.
Really appreciate it. Thank you so very much.
You got it, man. Thanks for having me. You guys take care.
Thanks for listening to the Walk Off Podcast with Scott Belford and Adam Mack, with a new episode every Friday.
Oh! Osborne with a drive. Cheese and crackers. Shows to pitch to him. Long move.
Thanks for listening.